Good morning. Well, in the introductory presentation last night, I opened up for us the what is a prophet? What is a genuine prophet? And it's not a very straightforward answer to that. But essentially, the contemporaries or people later on looking back recognize that the prophet was speaking in touch with reality and therefore in touch with God, and that he was speaking from, I suppose we'd say it, speaking from his prayer insights. At the same time, that didn't take him out of his culture, and there are quite a number of blind spots and things in the prophecy which Jesus, as he says later on, would say, well, it was said to you of old, yes, and it's not without value, but I say to you. Jesus had this knowledge of God, knowing God, that transcended all that had gone before him. And so we have to read the Old Testament through Jesus' eyes and with his heart, hopefully. We looked at that briefly, but we're going to touch on it as we look at the prophets, starting now. But then we looked at the history too, what was going on at the time of Jeremiah or just before him. And some of the key points were in 721, the Assyrian army sweeping west took the whole of Israel, the northern kingdom, and flattened Samaria, and there were all these refugees pouring down into Jerusalem from the north. 20 years later, the Assyrians then decided they swept into Judah and destroyed Judah, except that Jerusalem survived for reasons I mentioned last night. Then there was a long 60-year period where the king of Judah was really just a puppet king under the Assyrians, responsible for paying the tribute. And also they put, for example, a statue of the god of Assyria in the temple. So the temple became an out source of the worship of the Assyrians. So they were very subject to the Assyrian, couldn't do anything about it much. But then when Assyria was weakened, Josiah came, and that's where we'll start now. King Josiah, a young king in 640, but by the time he reached maturity, about 620, and took over the reins, he was determined to retake the northern kingdom and redream the dreams of this holy land that God had promised the people. And so a lot of writing came, Deuteronomy came supporting him, and he was supporting Deuteronomy, and a lot of the Torah starts to emerge. At that time, we have four prophets, including them all, and I'm going to now look at one of them now, who was a contemporary of Jeremiah, and just to watch him, and as we listen to him, it's not unlikely that Jeremiah listened to him, because it's not a very big place, Jerusalem. And let's now spend this time, not quite as crowded as last night, I promise, looking at a particular prophet and trying to discern in it what is a misunderstanding of God, yes, but the beautiful things that he has to say about God. It's the prophet Zephaniah, and the dates that scholars suggest for his public ministry are 628 to 620, all within the reign of King Josiah and the resurgence of nationalism and hope and promise. The prophecy begins, "The word of Yahweh." Yahweh, of course, is not just God. Whenever you see Yahweh or the Lord, as it's often translated in our Bibles, that's the God who revealed himself to Moses at the burning bush. That's the God who brought the Israelite slaves out of Egypt and the journey to the promised land. This is their God, a historical God who effected their history. So with the word of Yahweh came to Zephaniah, son of Cushi, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of King Josiah, son of Ammon of Judah. So that's the dating, the path there, that's Judah in the dark colours there, Jerusalem at the north, and most of the rest is desert. So 640, King Josiah became king at 8 years old. In 628 was the death of the king of Assyria. And so Josiah then took the occasion to break from being under them and create an independent place. And in 622 is the date given for the Deuteronomic reform, settling everything in Jerusalem, reforming the people, trying to go back to who they should be as God's people. And this reform was supported by our prophet. He's writing before it and during it and after it, after the reform. Zephaniah urges his contemporaries to turn to Yahweh before they're forced to face God's punishment for what they've been doing for the last 60 years, worshipping foreign gods and everything. He declares that the day of Yahweh, the day of the Lord, and that was talked about by many years before by Hosea in Northern Kingdom and Amos, the day of the Lord was thought to be the day when Yahweh would show that we are the chosen people, we the Jews, and would bring peace to the world and dominance by Israel. That's what they looked at it as, but the prophets keep twisting it and saying, wait a minute, the day of the Lord is the day when Yahweh shows who Yahweh is, and it may not be all to your benefit. So we'll go on. The day of the Lord is imminent. Like Amos, he knows that Yahweh is just. Judah would not be the only nation to face judgment. Amos spoke back in the Northern Kingdom of the crimes of Israel's neighbours, Syria, Philistia, Tyre, Edom, Ammon, Moab, and the punishment they were to endure. Similarly, we hear Zephaniah speaking out against Philistia, the Philistines, that's the coastland on the Mediterranean coast, because Judah is landlocked at this time, and Moab and Ammon, which are on the eastern borders of Judah. Though he speaks out against the people's sin, people of Judah's sin, and is firm in insisting on the need for repentance, that is not his main focus. It's never the main focus of the prophets. True prophet that he is, his focus is always on God, Yahweh, whose fidelity transcends human sin. Amos's scroll ends on this note, and as we'll see, so does Zephaniah's. The fidelity of God to the covenant, even whether we're faithful or not. I'll read the text for you shortly. After a century of subjection to Assyria, at last there was some hope of liberation. Assyria's power was declining, and no other power was yet threatening to take its place. And Judah had a king, Josiah, who listened to the forces who were pushing for religious reform. Most of Zephaniah's oracles, as we'll see, speak of God's judgment on the sins that he witnessed. The whole of the first chapter is devoted to God's threat of punishment of Judah. Judah's enemies too will be punished by God. If the people were ever to enjoy the presence of Yahweh in their midst and the blessing consequent upon such a communion, they would have to change their ways, and drastically change their ways. Like other prophets, he explained God's punishment as an instrument of bringing about the purifying of the nation. And he bemoans the failure of the people to repent. As a true prophet, his focus, as we'll see now, is on God, on Yahweh. And therefore he speaks of a remnant when people are unfaithful, but there'll always be a faithful few. There'll always be some who are saints. There'll always be people who listen to Yahweh and obey his will. And that's the hope of the nation. He concludes his prophecy, it's a brief one, with a remarkable statement of the passionate exuberance of God's longing for intimate communion with his people and the sheer delight God will have when this intimacy is restored. And I'm sure as we read it, we're thinking of today, we're thinking of our community, we're thinking of the church, we're thinking of our political parties, we're thinking of America and Russia and North Korea, and we're thinking of our world and the injustices that are there that need reforming and so on and so on, all of that. But over it all is this presence of a God who we would say doesn't punish. That's not what the punishment is, what we inflict on ourselves and on each other. That comes from sin. And when we behave badly, it has consequences which we can't pretend away. But they're not the consequences that God pushes on us. God is love. Jumping ahead of Zephaniah, of course, to Jesus. And God doesn't condemn. God loves us out of our sin. Please God. The text of the prophet is always in that cayenne, I think they call it, that reddish colour, so you can pick it. And it begins, I will utterly harvest. It's going to come back in the strip bare. I've got the Hebrew word there in English lettering. And one of the seasons of the year was the season of the asip, the gathering in of the crops, etc. So this is, he's going to come and gather it all in, but watch for it. Everything on the face of the earth, says Yahweh. I will harvest humans and animals. I'll harvest the birds of the air and the fish of the sea and those who cause the wicked to stumble. I will cut off humanity from the face of the earth, says Yahweh. This is what the prophet's saying. God regrets that he made us, we're so bad, and he's going to cut us off from the earth. That will remind you of texts from the book of Genesis. And while without thinking we might imagine Genesis is older than Zephaniah, it's not. Genesis is quite likely post-exilic, so it's in a century later. And the language of the authors of the book of Genesis are clearly, in this case, borrowing from Zephaniah, whom they're hearing in their synagogues. And I'll give you a couple of texts that you'll know from the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 6, verse 7 reads, this is before the flood, eh? This is the mythology of the early, it's not history, it's big dramatic stuff about being man and being woman and being community. Yahweh says, I will blot out from the earth the human beings I have created. People together with animals and creeping things and birds of the air, for I'm sorry that I've made them. Extraordinary image of God in the authors of that part of the Torah. God is regretting having made us because we're making such a bad job of our own lives and the lives of the world. Genesis also says in chapter 7, verse 4, in 7 days I will send rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. And every living thing that I've made, I will blot out from the face of the ground. You know, and I won't go into it now, of course, because we're not doing the book of Genesis, but in fact, this threat isn't carried out. It is, but not really, because there was one, it's the power of one. There was one just human being on the earth. And that one just being on the earth saved the earth. And that's, you can put it dramatically as in the book of Genesis, or just all we need is one saint in a community to save us all. So be that saint, please, for us all. And Noah was that one. And Noah is told to build an ark. It's not a boat, it's a temple. And the temple rises above all the chaos of the earth. And then out of the temple comes all light and all new life onto the earth. It's not history, it's Shakespearean drama. Well, there it is in the book of Genesis. And the language of God's anguish or sorrow at having created us, they pick up from the prophecy of Zephaniah. Zephaniah, I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against the inhabitants of Jerusalem. I will cut off from the place every remnant of Baal. Baal is the Canaanite god of the harvest and war and all that kind of thing. So this is the foreign god. And the name of an idolater, the idolatrous priests, worshipping the god of Assyria, like we might worship the American dollar, or our own dollar, or our own systems of government, or our own whatever. Those who bow down on the roofs of the hosts of the heavens. And they looked at the gods of the stars. They thought the stars were living. In fact, people thought they were living right through to the medieval period. They were earth, air, fire and water. Well, fire is the most beautiful of the elements. So when they looked at the stars, they didn't know what we know. The stars were actually angels, really. And they were fire. They were the perfect human beings looking down on the earth. And hence astrology and all the rest of it grew up around that. Those who bow down on the roofs of to the hosts of the heavens, those who bow down and swear to Yahweh, but also swear to their king, those who've turned back from following Yahweh, who have not sought Yahweh or inquired of him. Sought Yahweh or inquired of him. They got locked into, and we can all do this, as you know, they got locked into their own systems and their own logic and their own atheistic view of the world and so on, and didn't penetrate to the heart of reality or their own heart, and there discover the mystery that we call the presence we talked about in that song last night, called by a presence. That can be overlooked in our busy materialist lives. Be silent, says Zephaniah. And just for fun, I mean, I could do a lot more of this and I won't because it's hardly appropriate. The Hebrew word for be silent is hus. Hus. It's kind of pretty perfect, isn't it? For and of course, that's all their language is full of. This is full of poetry, but you can't ever get poetry when you translate it. But believe me, there is a lot of poetic assonance and rhyme and rhythm, all kinds of stuff in here. Just we can only get the content of it. Be silent before the Lord Yahweh, for the day of Yahweh is at hand. And according to Zephaniah, don't immediately think it's the day when God will make you great and crush your enemies. By no means. It's the day when truth will prevail. Amos, many years before in the Northern Kingdom, chapter 5 said, and you can see the parallels here, Zephaniah is learning from Amos. Of course they are. Why do you want the day of Yahweh? Why do you want it? It's darkness, says Amos, not light. As if someone fled from a lion and was met by a bear. in our terms, between a rock and a hard place, but this is much more poetic. Or went into a house and rested a hand against the wall and was bitten by a snake. Is not the day of Yahweh darkness, not light? It's gloom with no brightness in it, says Amos. And he's writing to a decadent community who are, the city is growing, this is Samaria, growing in wealth, and they're building palaces, and they've got this, and they've got everything going for them. Why? And at the expense of the farmers and the poor who have been crushed and put down. So Amos is violently aggressive against this terrible state of affairs. It's not as bad at the time of Zephaniah, but it's still there. And it's still here. Zephaniah continues, on the day of Yahweh's sacrifice, I will punish the officials and the king's sons and all who dress themselves in foreign attire, picking up the habits of the Assyrian dominant power. On that day, I'll punish all who cross the threshold, that's the priest, the threshold of the temple, and fill the house of their Lord with violence and fraud. On that day, says Yahweh, a cry will be heard from the fish gate, a wail from the second quarter, these are areas of Jerusalem, a loud tumult from the hills, the inhabitants of the mortar, the commercial district in Jerusalem, wail, for all the traders have perished, all who weigh out silver are cut off. At that time, Yahweh speaking through the prophet, or that's how they interpreted it, I'll search Jerusalem with lamps. You might be able to hide from this judgment. And I'll punish the people who rest complacently on their dregs, those who say in their hearts, Yahweh will not do good. He won't do harm either. Yahweh's irrelevant. Let's get on with life. Let's build a future for ourselves and our families and the rest of it, considering Yahweh's a waste of time. He's not going to interfere, they were saying. Their wealth shall be plundered, their houses will be laid waste. Though they build houses, they shall not inhabit them. Though they plant vineyards, they will not drink the wine from them. You can see the coming cataclysm, if you like, in Jerusalem. The great day of Yahweh is near, near and hastening fast. The sound of the day of Yahweh is bitter. The warrior cries aloud there. That day will be a day of wrath. And if you go to the translation of that into Greek and then into Latin, you might know from your childhood the hymn, oh, I wish I could sing it, I'll make a noise anyhow. Dies irae, dies illa. You remember that? It's a hymn about this. Well, that dies irae comes from here. The day of wrath. A day of distress and anguish. A day of ruin and devastation. A day of darkness and gloom. A day of clouds and thick darkness. A day of trumpet blast and battle cry. Against the fortified cities and against the lofty battlements, I will bring such distress upon people that they shall walk like the blind because they've sinned against Yahweh. Their blood shall be poured out like dust and their innards like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold will be able to save them on the day of Yahweh's wrath. In the fire of his passion, all the land will be consumed, for a terrible end he will make of all the inhabitants of the land. Zephaniah, an intelligent, insightful prophet, can see that Jerusalem is hurtling towards destruction by its stupidity and its political alliances, and that the Babylonian army will surely come in and crush it. And he was right. That's why they've kept his prophecy. That's why they look at him as a prophet, because he actually saw things as they were. But he's seeing it, of course, and this is where I'm assuming we would all differ from him. He's seeing this as God raising up Babylon to do the destruction. Zephaniah chapter 2. Gather together, gather, O shameless nation, before the decree comes into effect and the day comes and goes like the drifting, like drifting chaff. They throw the wheat up in the air to winnow it, as you know, and the wind catches it, and the grain being heavier lands, and the chaff is kind of blown by the wind, and that keeps the wheat pure. Before the decree comes in and the day comes and goes like the drifting chaff, before there comes upon you the fierce anger of Yahweh, before there comes upon you the day of Yahweh's wrath. Seek Yahweh, all you oppressed, the anawim, the poor, all you oppressed of the land, seek Yahweh. Carry out his commands. Seek righteousness. Seek humility. Ani. So it's the same word as anawim, really. Seek dependence on God. Listen to God. Let God love you and stop all this crazy behavior. Perhaps you may be hidden on the day of Yahweh's wrath. Just as the story goes in Exodus, as you know, when God is going to kill all the firstborn. Well, God never killed the firstborn, and I could go into that, but I won't now. But to protect, they had to put a cross sign, really, on the top of where they lived, so that the angel would come and pass over them and only kill the Egyptian firstborn and not the Israelite firstborn. Well, here he's saying, if you behave like this, you poor of the land, then maybe you'll be hidden and God's anger will pass you by and you'll survive the storm. Then comes an oracle against Philistia. Philistia is the land on the western side of Judah, and between there and the Mediterranean. And it's Gaza, for example, the Philistine area. Gaza shall be forsaken. Ashkelon will be desolate. Ashdod's people shall be driven out at noon, and Ekron shall be uprooted, the four big cities of the Philistine power. Woe, O you inhabitants of the sea coast, you nation of the Kerethites. The word of Yahweh is against you, O Canaan, land of the Philistines, and I will destroy you until no inhabitant is left. God is going to destroy Judah if they don't repent. God is certainly going to destroy Philistia, says the prophet. And at this time, Egypt is starting to get power, and Egypt is entering, and Egypt isn't interested, particularly in the hill country of Judah. I mean, what's the point? But the land is important, because between Egypt, which you can't see on that map, it's the bottom left-hand side, the way of the sea, the armies would frequently find their way up that flat land with chariots and all the rest of it, which they can't do in the hill country. So that's the way to get to Damascus and then to what we'll call Turkey and so on, Syria, Assyria, etc. So the Philistines are being crushed by Egypt at this time. And then he has something to say, having spoken about what's going to happen to the coastlands of Philistia. He goes on and he says, the sea coast will become pasture, wells for shepherds and folds for flocks. The seacoast will become the possession of the remnant of the house of Judah. So with all this destructive stuff he's talking about, God is there and he loves his people and he's going to make sure there is a remnant and they're going to be blessed and they're actually going to take over the land of the Philistines. And the lowland where they can have wheat and crops and things which are difficult in the mountain area. On which they shall pasture, and in the houses of Ashkelon they shall lie down at evening, for Yahweh their God will be mindful of them and will restore their fortunes. Then comes an oracle against Moab. Here you can see it there. Moab and Ammon on the eastern border of Judah. I have heard, says the prophet, speaking for God, from God. I have heard, that's how he sees it and how the other people see it. I have heard the taunts of Moab and the revilings of the Ammonites, how they have taunted my people and made inroads into their territory. As I live, says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, Moab shall become like Sodom and the Ammonites like Gomorrah. A land possessed by nettles and salt pits and a waste forever. Way back in history, before any of this time, there was a tremendous, I'll call it earthquake, seismic activity. And as you probably know, the deepest rift in the world's surface is the Jordan River and going right down, in fact, it goes right down to Lake Victoria in Africa. It's the deepest rift, and so there was all that stuff would be remembered, of course, and handed down. And Sodom and Gomorrah are the cities, two of the cities that went under the Dead Sea, swamped by this salt water and all the rest of it. So they became symbols again. They thought God did this. Earthquakes don't happen without God doing them, as they saw it. So God did it to punish, and then the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is in the book of Genesis, should you want to read it. But they became symbolic, and they still remain that even in the New Testament, of cities that are destroyed by God because of their pagan behaviour, or whatever you call it. Well, here they come in again in the prophecy of Zephaniah. He continues, the remnant of my people, so those who are faithful in this land, God won't punish the innocent. The remnant of my people will plunder them, Moab and Ammon, and the survivors of my nation shall possess them. The promise of the promised land is still hovering. Thus, this shall be their lot in return for their pride, because they, that's Ammon and Moab, because they scoffed and boasted against the people of Yahweh of hosts. So yes, God will punish Judah for what's going on there, as the prophet sees it. But don't think these other countries won't also come under God's wrath. Zephaniah 2:11, Yahweh will bring down all the gods of the earth, and to him shall bow down, each in its place, all the coasts and islands of the nations. Extraordinary vision of the future, where ultimately all lands, according to Zephaniah, will come and worship God in Judah, and the whole world will be converted. That, of course, is picked up in the New Testament by Paul and others, who saw that their beautiful faith, the faith of Judaism, was meant to be taken to the whole world, to liberate the world. And that's what Pentecost is about, and all the nations there on that feast of Pentecost from everywhere hearing about the good news. But that's jumping ahead. I'll read it again and then read what I've written here in it as a comment. Yahweh will bring down all the gods of the earth, and to him shall bow down each in its place, all the coasts and islands of the nations. The focus widens here from Moab and Philistia, Moab and Ammon, to all the gods of the earth. Ultimately, all the gods will bow down and worship of Yahweh. They weren't monotheists at this stage. Monotheism is an extraordinarily rare insight. They all presumed every nation had its own god. The only god to be worshipped, they call it monolatry, not monotheism, was Yahweh, of course. But all these other gods were real, and they governed their particular nations, and all of those gods are going to worship Yahweh. Monotheism, Jesus was a monotheist. Francis of Assisi was. There must be a third somewhere. I think it's a rare enough thing. Most of us, perhaps, most people think our God is God, but he's not their God. So that's not monotheism. A monotheist is aware of the sacredness of every person, every nation, every group, every community, because all of them are expressions of the one God. Because today no one will accept anything else. The young certainly won't, because they know about world wide webs and all our interconnections. And maybe when I grew up and Catholics were Catholics and Protestants weren't and all that, and it wasn't all that bad, but it wasn't all that good either. But that's dead. And any religious community that sees itself as belonging to God and others don't, well, for heaven's sake, what are they talking about? That's not monotheism. If you take monotheism to its extreme, which we should, then we'd be very ecologically conscious, and I guess from St. Francis is my most obvious monotheist that I know from history. This will be seen by the defeat of all Israel's enemies. Jerusalem will be restored as the centre of the earth, as Zephaniah sees it, the holy place from which Yahweh's glory will radiate out to, quote, all the coasts and islands of the nations. Then comes an oracle against Cush. It's only one line. You also, O Cush, are slain by my sword. This needs a bit of explanation, so I'll offer it to you. Zephaniah illustrates the point about the eventual submission of all the earth to Yahweh, and therefore to faithful Israel, by referring to the people of Cush, commonly identified with Ethiopia, but generally referring to the scarcely known lands to the south of Egypt. No one had ever gone there. It was beyond. So here's Egypt. And down here, a totally unknown, dark, they know it must be there, but whatever that is, that's Cush. I suppose Sudan today we might call it, but it's vague because it's unknown territory. Bit of history that will help explain that. It may interest you here. There's the map again, and I'll read my comment. From 747 to 664, the pharaohs of Egypt were from Cush, from the south. They raided the north, and they became pharaohs. Extraordinary, but it's true, historically. So that's for quite a period. 747 to 764, I'm not sure, that's 80 years or something. Now, this ended, this Cushite dynasty in Egypt, ended with the destruction of Thebes in 663 by the Assyrians. supported by a man called Psamtek I, who became Pharaoh, and there's his dates, during this period we're talking about, during the period of Zephaniah, and remained an ally of Assyria. So the Assyrians conquered the Cushite pharaohs, and then Psamtek I started another dynasty, an Egyptian dynasty. It was the Egyptian army under Psamtek who was moving against Philistia, and we just read that a few verses back. There's Zephaniah's dates again, 628 to 620, and so this is the period. It seems to be referring to the defeat of the Cushite dynasty in 664 as another example of Yahweh's action in history. He's reading history that way. He sees the strengthening of Egypt as a sign of the weakening of Assyria, which they're looking forward to because Assyria is the dominant, the evil empire of the day. And now an oracle against Assyria, northern Iraq in our terms. He, that's Yahweh, will extend his hand against the north. He will destroy Assyria. He will make Nineveh, the capital, a desolation, an arid wasteland like the desert. Herds will lie down in it. Every wild animal, pelican and porcupine, will lodge on its capitals. The owl shall hoot at the window, and the raven croak on the threshold, for cedar will be stripped. Is this the exultant city that lived secure, that said to itself, I am, claiming divinity, eh? And there is no one else? What a desolation it has become. A lair for wild animals. Everyone who passes by it hisses and shakes the fist. At the time he's writing, they are the dominant force, but they're starting to weaken, and Zephaniah is looking forward to their total collapse, which will, of course, as he sees it, liberate Judah. Zephaniah read the signs well, for the Assyrian Empire was crushed with the destruction of its ancient capital, Ashur, in 614, by the combined forces of Babylon and the Medes. The destruction of Nineveh followed in 612. What we're saying is he could foresee that coming. Woe, O rebellious, defiled, oppressing city. Now he turns his attention. This is not logical. Who knows when all these various things were said, they're piled together by some scribes, but the timing of them isn't chronological. Woe, O rebellious, defiled, oppressing city. She has listened to no voice. She has accepted no instruction. She's not trusted in Yahweh. She's not drawn near to her God. And then he criticizes the various important, if I may use the word, communities in Jerusalem. The officials in her midst are roaring lions. They're just making money out of everybody. The banks, whatever. The judges are evening wolves that leave nothing till the morning. Their fangs, they're just destroying people, gobbling them up for their own wealth and power and so on. The prophets are reckless, faithless. They say they're speaking from God, but they're not, says Zephaniah. The priests profane what is sacred and they do violence to the Torah. A powerful list of critique of the main communities. But you need to notice there's one particular person in that that is not attacked. King Josiah. The prophets, normally the king is the first one there criticizing, because he's got the ultimate power, of course. So, but Josiah was a wonderful king, and he was reforming the nation, and he was doing everything to help bring about justice and peace, and then etc. So Zephaniah is living at the time. He's not attacking him, because he's actually one of the most important powerful good, which is rare, but it's here. Yahweh, he continues, in her midst is righteous. Yahweh does no wrong. Every morning he renders his judgment. The way they did judgment was so much better than ours. God, why have we gone backwards so fast? If there was a case to be answered, it was answered in the morning. The only place they could have, because all the little narrow streets, etc., was before the gate. So that people would gather in that square before the gate, and the judgment would be made, and there'd be either punishment or acquittal. We wait for years, don't we, to get justice for anybody. And in the meantime, the papers are full of them, as though they're guilty. It's a dreadful system we've got. It's absolutely shocking. But anyhow, it's not here, thank God. Yahweh will rend every morning, will render judgment. Each dawn without fail. He knows no wrong, no shame. I have cut off nations, their battlements are in ruins. I've laid waste their streets so that no one walks in them. Their cities have been made desolate, without people, without inhabitants. And I said, surely the city will fear me and accept correction. She will not lose sight of all that I have brought upon her. As God acts against Moab and Ammon and Philistia, etc., and now Assyria, surely the people will learn. Surely. But they were the more eager to corrupt everything they did. Therefore, wait for me, says Yahweh. For the day when I arise for prey, P-R-E-Y, for my decision is to harvest nations. We had that word right at chapter 1, verse 1. To assemble kingdoms, to pour out upon them my indignation, all the heat of my anger. For in the fire of my passion, all the earth will be consumed. At that time, I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech. The punishment of God they always saw as purifying. At that time, I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, that all of them may call on the name of Yahweh and serve him with one accord, with one heart, with one mind and one heart. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my suppliants, my scattered ones, shall bring my cereal offering. Zephaniah envisages a time when the nations will experience a conversion to Yahweh and come from the ends of the earth to offer sacrifice to Yahweh in Jerusalem. The picture of people from the ends of the earth, quote, beyond the rivers of Cush, bring cereal offerings to Yahweh. It points to Zephaniah's ministry being before Judah's relations with Egypt soured in the latter part of Josiah's reign. So he's putting a lot of hope in Egypt converting to Yahweh. On that day, you will not be put to shame because of all the deeds by which you have rebelled against me. For then I will remove from your midst your proud, exultant ones, and you shall no longer be haughty in my holy mountain. God will remove the oppressors and the haughty ones. And, to continue, I will leave in your midst a humble people, a lowly people. They will seek refuge in the name of Yahweh. The remnant, the ones left over from this scourge, this terrible, destructive stuff that's going on in the historical situation of the day. The remnant of Israel will do no wrong and utter no lies, nor shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouths. Then they will pasture and lie down, and no one will make them afraid. A comment: since the temple and the feast of Sukkot, that's the feast of the gathering in, because when they had to do that, everyone came from everywhere to do it, after it was gathered in, and then they had a holiday, the farmers had a holiday because of the season, and they could pilgrim to Jerusalem and offer their gifts to God, and kind of, I suppose, a relaxing time, really. And the hills were all dotted, because there wasn't enough room in the city, with tents and that, and booths, we'll call them, tabernacles, where people just roughed it to be all around Jerusalem. And that's the beginning of the Feast of Sukkot. So, since the temple and the Feast of Sukkot is the likely context for Zephaniah's oracles, that's where he's doing his preaching, it's not surprising that the qualities of the remnant of Israel described in this verse are the qualities required of a person who wishes to enter the temple. And you can read those Psalms where it says, who will enter the temple of God? And then it goes on to describe pretty well what Zephaniah has described here. Humble, lowly people. And then comes a bit of Zephaniah that you know best, and it's probably the most beautiful part. Well, it's a matter of opinion, of course. God has a married relationship with his people, a spousal love. It's like the different kinds of mysticism they talk about, spousal mysticism, like John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, etc. And then the apophatic mysticism, which is beyond thought, beyond words. But this is the spousal image of a God who actually loves and is committed to his people, and they were committed to him too. But they're breaking that commitment, hence punishment, but hence also the remnant who are faithful enjoying this. So I'll read it, chapter 3, verse 14, the following. Sing aloud, O daughter Zion, shout, Israel. Rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter Jerusalem. Yahweh has taken away the judgments against you. He has turned away your enemies. The King of Israel, Yahweh, is in your midst. You shall fear disaster no more. So behind all his urgent wishing, people, more than wishing, people would change, his image of God is still ultimately the husband of the people, the lover, the committed lover. And he goes on to say, on that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, do not fear, O Zion. Do not let your hands grow weak. Yahweh your God is in your midst, a warrior who gives victory. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will renew you in his love. And an extraordinary image, unique in the Bible. He will dance over you with loud singing as on a day of festival. So there's God dancing in the city with his people. Extraordinary image. And there it is in Zephaniah. Those who suffered when I harvested you were a burden upon her, a reproach. I'm dealing with all who oppress you at that time, and I'll save the latter and gather the outcast, and I'll change their shame into peace and renown in all the earth. At that time I will bring you home, at the time when I gather you, for I will make you renowned and praised among all the peoples of the earth, when I restore your fortunes before your eyes, says Yahweh. That's actually the end of Zephaniah, that beautiful ending we've just had, full of hope. And I'm going to sing a bit of music for you in a couple of minutes' time that you know well, that picks that up. Nahum was another contemporary of Jeremiah, and I won't do it. It's not a very nice prophecy, really. He's very happy to see Nineveh falling, which it is. It was destroyed by the Babylonians in South Iraq, and the Medes, Iranians, we've called them today. Those two pincered in and they just destroyed all this. And he's totally delighted. And if you want to read it, good luck. It's there to be read. It's only a brief prophecy, but I think I've said enough of all this kind of destructive stuff for you. So I'll just take you to the end. Judah had felt the oppressive power of Assyria since Assyria's westward expansion under Tiglath-Pileser III in 734 in the Northern Kingdom. His successor, Shalmaneser, conquered the Northern Kingdom Israel, and in 721 he was replaced by Sargon II, whose son, Sennacherib, and you might know Sennacherib came down like a wolf on the fold. We all learned that in primary school. He devastated Judah in 701. Sennacherib chose to make Nineveh his capital. And Nahum is delighting in the imminent fall of Nineveh, the capital of the dark empire. The capital of the empire that had destroyed Israel, had annexed the land to the east of the Jordan, controlled Philistia, and for over a century had kept Judah in subjection, even insisting on worship of the Assyrian gods in the temple of Jerusalem. Assyria's decline was evident in 627 when Ashurbanipal died. In 614, Ashur, the religious capital, fell, and in 612, Nineveh was captured by the Medes with the backing of the Babylonians. So that's our prophet Zephaniah, and I'll conclude kind of stuck, a very difficult period of the collapse of this whole part of the world. And yet, also, as in Zephaniah, behind all this, wanting people to repent and change and avoid the cataclysm by their behaviour and their political manoeuvring, etc. While wanting all that, behind all that is God. And in this case, God dancing with love over his people. So he's wanting to, I suppose, the stick and the carrot a bit. He's trying to attract the community that he's living in to repent and to enjoy the communion with God that God wants. And must be the same for us. So at 11:15, I'll be here again if you want to come. It's up to you, of course, at your retreat, but I'll be doing the prophet Habakkuk, who also has some beautiful stuff to present, and then tomorrow morning we'll begin with Jeremiah. Thank you.